Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Welcome back to the Rugby League Digest. I'm Michael Adams, and I'm here with the most special guest of all, the doyen of rugby league history in Australia, our first three-time guest. It's Ian Heads. How are you, Ian?
Very good. Thanks, Michael. Thank you for the kind words.
They're very well deserved, because I was saying to you before we started that in this project, I've now passed 900,000 words of compiled research notes. It's not an exaggeration to say some 50 or 100,000 of those are yours in between your books, Rugby League Week, the Sun Herald. So you were certainly crucial to journalism throughout the period we've been looking at.
Yeah, oh, thanks, mate. You're very kind. Makes me think I've been here too long.
Well, I've got a lot I want to cover today, but that's one of the reasons I particularly want to speak to you is we chose to start our story with the Humphreys era.
Yeah.
There are a couple of distinct reasons for doing that. The main one is the way the Humphreys story is bookended by taking the reins in 73, within a day of replacing Bill Buckley, publicly saying in the press that we could bring in a Super League, and then his eventual downfall in 1983, you could make a very sound argument that that is what set us on the path to everything that happened in 1995.
Exactly, yeah. Certainly, he was an action man. You've sort of summed him up there, Kevin. And he had his enemies and a lot of supporters, but he loved the game, and he was a bloke who got things done. You know, he had the league had strong leaders down the years, but he was certainly in that line. You know, he was a very forceful bloke and a brilliant orator. You know, they called him the boy orator, and he was as good as you'd hear. You know, off the cuff stuff at a function or something, he was terrific at that.
Mm.
So he was a good leader, you know, with a bit of a modern thing about him at that time, with Jersey Flagg having gone and then
Bill Buckley.
Bill Buckley too, yeah, who were both really good, solid rugby league men. Buckley particularly, I thought, was an outstanding bloke. He worked for the Water Board, loved rugby league. He played it in the very early years and had a vision for it too, you know, which was a bit ahead of his time, really. He was... His great passion was he wanted to build a super rugby league ground at Newtown, on the brickworks there at Newtown, and he fought hard for that over the years, but money was short, I think, and I don't know how much support he had. It didn't happen, but I think it was a bit of a tragedy for old Bill. He put so much effort into that, but a good man, a good straight shooter and blunt, and Monday nights down there were... You know, I think you would pay to go into them. Yeah. They were pretty lively, spectacular at times. Even fisticuffs once or twice.
I was going to say, were you? There's some legendary stories of brawls in the hallways. Were you personally witness to any of those?
Well, I was there the night of John O'Toole, and I'll come back to him in a minute. There was a wrestle through the big solid main door between these two, but there was a lot of... very vibrant brigade, you know, discussion in the rooms, because Monday nights, I mean, it would be a wonderful presentation if you could put on one Monday night, because they came from all over Sydney. They would meet in, the delegates would meet, they had their particular hotels where they wanted to meet, and they all got there early, had a few beers and maybe a few more when they got to the club. And then by the time the meeting started, it was, you know, things could get pretty fiery, which they did from time to time. But... it was highly entertaining, and they were really good, great rugby league blokes, really, you know. And Kevin Humphreys got together a group of those, or he had a group of sort of followers, Peter Moore amongst them, some others, who were the sort of new thinkers. They'd moved on to the next generation after Bill Buckley.
Well, that's one of the things I wanted to ask you about. So the cartel, as they were known, in your book with Ken Arthurson, he talked about butting heads with Buckley, even though Buckley was someone he greatly respected.
Yep.
Just that new generation coming through. Did you notice a difference in style or the way they operated between the Cartel and, you know, the Buckleys, the faces of the earlier era?
Yeah, I think so. I think the Buckley era, I mean, they were just good, really good, solid working class blokes who loved rugby league and had played it back in the very early days. So they had a great feeling for the game, but there was more slickness about the next generation. If they were capable maybe of some new thought about how the game should go, and maybe that led to what happened eventually. But just as committed. I don't think there was any difference in the commitment of a Buckley or a Humphreys or a Peter Moore. They loved the game. And probably served it pretty well. I mean, there were things we'll probably talk about along the way where they came under the spotlight. But the passion of those blokes sticks with me still. And there was a really nice relationship with the media. One thing that sticks with me on those nights at the Monday nights at the league, when there'd probably be five or six media people sitting at the table down the front. It was like an old Greek auditorium, and the members of the committee would sit up there at the back, having had numbers of beers and things, and there would be the occasional sound of snoring would rent the room. You know, one or two might drift off. That was part of it. But down the front, Bill Buckley sat behind us down the front, and I was with, famous league blokes, Bill Morty and Ernie Christensen, Alan Clarkson, guys like that. We'd sit at a desk down the front. But it was just one small example, which sometimes shine on bigger light on things too. At a certain time in the meeting, Bill Buckley and then Humphreys followed him in the same pattern in later years. Gentlemen, we're now going into committee phase, words to that effect, at which point the media down the front, there was a physical gesture of putting your pen down on the board, so we were not going to take any notes at all. But they'd still leave us in the room. It wouldn't happen now. You know, I'm sure, you know, the media wouldn't often get into a meeting where, you know, important things were discussed about the future of the game and all that sort of stuff, you know. But so there was trust on both sides from the league, and the media responded to that. Although afterwards, when they would tap the keg in the after the meeting, and the boys had had a few beers beforehand, and then they would tap the keg, and there was a fair bit of discussion. Then we'd go on a little more privately, you know, between people, and it got, you know, noisier and noisier. Really, there was, but it was a lot of fun. It was a chance for the media. I was a young media bloke then to meet these fellas, and there was that nice sense of trust there. You know, that we were like them. We liked the game. We were working class people, and it all worked very well. And even occasionally there'd be music there. Harry McKinnon at North Sydney could play the mouth organ, so he used to bring out the mouth organ. So some chance of a sing-along or...
What was he like, blues-style harmonica? What was his...
No, I think it was pretty sort of traditional stuff, nothing too... But I think there was occasionally they'd probably sing along a bit, but it didn't happen every week. But they'd bring out the highlight of the night. Well, there's few highlights of any night at the league, but it was when they... the ladies who worked behind would bring out the cold collation, so they'd have this food, which was pretty ordinary, I've got to say. And the players, then having had several beers, would then hoe into the food. So it was a bit of a social thing, really, you know.
Yeah.
But with a hard edge, you know, they would have made tough decisions. There were times when Buckley and Jersey Flegg had sent blokes from the room. You know, the level of debate was... got very heated at times. There were some really tough characters there, blokes who played the game at a high level, and you know, the few beers in town beforehand had sort of added to the what was going on there. So they'd be solidly debated things, and there were some great debaters in the room, I've got to say. Latcham Robinson from Newtown, Balmain, always sticks in my mind. Latcham was character, and he'd been a great player and great storyteller, really. But he would sometimes days off, so as I said, the sound of snoring would rent the room, you know, and they'd have to pause. But so it was good. It was as good as going to the movies or something, you know, to be there. So it was my growing up period, you know, so I look back on it now with a great deal of affection, because they were good fellas, they loved the game, they'd played it, they'd worked for it, and there were some really good pragmatic thinkers there too, who thought about what should be happening with the game.
Well, one of the paradoxes for me about Humphreys in particular is he had the reputation of a great orator, you know, ahead of his time, all the rest of it. But he left the game in many ways on its knees. You know, crowds were falling through the bottom. There were all these problems, you know, the on-field violence, which he was starting to clean up, but all these other problems, and rugby league was in a very poor state at the time of incorporation. How do you square that, you know, this talented guy with what the game became when he left it?
Yeah, I think he had, you know, he had a genuine love of the game and a belief that there are things that should get done, but you're quite right. There were things that should have happened that didn't happen, whether he just didn't get round to them. He wasn't distracted by other things, I guess. He was a punter, and you know that story of it sort of brought him down in the end. And he surrounded himself with a little group, the cartel. And there was some bit of talent there too. Some good thinkers on the game there, but they were. I think they just enjoyed being involved. I don't know whether the deep thinking that, you know, probably should have been pursued a bit more, whether that went on as it should have. But, an interesting figure in the game's past, Kevin Humphreys. I personally found him very good to deal with, but I was aware of the drawbacks with him, and the punt was, you know, was a problem. And but he carried on the strength of the two preceding chairman, in that he was a tough bloke who would make hard decisions. And there's a story that sort of reflects to me, something that stuck in my mind, which I've probably written about over the years, of which sort of indicated the strength of the bloke. He was such a good orator. And there was a particular night, there were probably other nights the same thing happened, but there'd been a big debate in the room, and Humphreys had overpowered the others, and he'd won the debate. There'd been a bit of disagreement about it and that sort of thing, but he'd won the debate, and so it was a triumphant night for him. But it was this great moment afterwards when one of the blokes, Bobby Seabrook from Eastern Suburbs, he was a great character, Bob, who was another knockabout who played the game and that sort of thing. He was seen after the meeting being down at the front of the room, reaching underneath and moving things around. And someone said to him, what are you doing, Bob? And he said, I'm just trying to find the handle, that Kevin's handle that makes all the hands go up. That's what he was saying, because Humphreys had swept the room, you know, that night. And Bob pictured it, and that's exactly what it was. You know, Humphreys had a triumphant meeting, and everything that he'd wanted done was passed. So Bobby sort of interpreted that in his own way, which was pretty clever, really.
Turning to beyond Humphreys, was the change instant once the league was incorporated, and you had a, you know, very new way of doing things with Bellew taking over and Arthurson and Quayle, you know, taking command too? Did you notice that change immediately?
It was sort of gradual to an extent, but then it accelerated, I think, that that feeling. And there were blokes are a bit more modern day savvy, I suppose, that Quayle did a very good job, you know, and the others had the sense of what was needed. So maybe the fun went out of it a bit, to an extent. And it got, you know, when the war broke out and that sort of thing, I mean, it was pretty really ugly stuff, you know. Nobody was laughing too much then. But I think the basic thing that these Bill Buckley's offside, the blokes who had been his running mates, that sort of thing, they remain strong in the game, you know, because they love the game, I think. That was it. You know, it had been part of their lives, their whole lives, so it was a natural reaction, I guess, to try and get it right. And if you've got an interloper coming in trying to nick your game, well, you're going to fight back against it. And that's and they certainly did that. There was a lot of bitterness and, as you well know, you know, a bit of bitterness and argument. And it was an ugly, really ugly time, I've got to say, that developed.
Mm.
Probably said something for rugby league, but it was a good and popular game, which was well suited to television, had all the things going for it, you know, and you know, it was a victim of its own success, I suppose.
Mm. Well, just on that, just before we get to the war itself, the Quayle and Arthurson relationship is something that I find endlessly fascinating. You have Arthurson as this, you know, he was a member of cartel, been with Manly since, you know, the late 40s, rugby league man through and through. And seems kind of the old school, had that cunning but the affability. He seems like a very traditional rugby league man. Quayle also, you know, played, you know, esteemed playing career, you know, on the Bordered East Leagues. Rugby league man too,
yep.
But had this newer style, maybe a more professional edge.
Yes, more polish about him, I think, in that way. But funnily enough, they worked I've never said to John Cry, what did you think about Ken, you know? But it worked very well between them, actually, I must say, that Arthur's a very affable fellow. He's everyone's best friend, you know. If you went to a function with him, Arco, good to see you, you know, everyone was happy to see Arco. And yet he was a skillful worker behind the scenes, you know, and Manly was the biggest thing in his life. And he's a very shrewd operator, but the balance sort of worked all right. Quayle acquired his sort of education in those years, probably, in fighting against the Murdoch, the invaders, and in becoming more of a businessman. And but he, I've never heard him, you know, speak in a derogatory way about Ken, although Ken, you know, had his enemies, and they all did. There were a few feuds within the structure, but he was a smart bloke. He just knew how things worked. He'd been here a long time in rugby league, and certainly made his contribution. But as I said, he and John, I think, worked pretty well together.
Mm. When did you first become aware of Super League? Can you remember the first whispers you heard?
Yes, I can. There was an event that happened when the Super League, the heat, you know, was getting hotter. The battle was building up, and I'd been on the edge of it. I'd been at Rugby League Week for some years, and then I left them, just thought I did some writing for the Sun Herald, and later even the Murdoch Press, which I didn't expect that to happen, but it happened because for a particular reason. But John Quayle invited Peter Frelingos, was the number one rugby league writer at the Mirror. He'd taken over from Bill Morty. He learnt the ropes from Bill, I guess. And he and I, Peter and I, had gone sort of been a parallel careers, I suppose, almost. And we got on well together. We're good friends and that sort of thing. But the awareness came to me very strongly on a single night when John Quayle invited Peter and myself and our wives to have dinner at his place at Centennial, outside Centennial Park, lovely spot actually. And we went to that, and it was there when it was right on the cusp of the story breaking about how big this was going to be. And I remember it so well, the dinner. He was, amongst other things, Quayle's a very good cook, so he cooked this beautiful meal, prepared all this fancy stuff, you know, which is, I've written somewhere, is not a renowned skill of rugby league administrators, I wouldn't think, but he did. So we had this wonderful dinner and just normal conversation, you know, nothing particularly being discussed. But at the end of the dinner, he said, I just want to talk about a few things that are happening in the game. So from that point, he took us through, Frelingos and I, through what was happening, the gathering threat from the Murdoch company to take over rugby league and, you know, put it under their umbrella. And so it went from being quite a relaxed, humorous sort of a dinner to something very serious. And that was, I'd been aware, there'd been hints, you know. Tony Durkin wrote a good piece about it from Queensland about the rumour doing the rounds about this invasion was coming, that rugby league was going to change. But that night, Quayle really put us in the picture, what was going on. So that was my... I hadn't been quite as much involved. I sort of had a little bit more in the background at that time, but it was quite an education. I think that's what John wanted to happen. He wanted to say, this, you blokes, I'm just telling you, this is what's happening. He said, it's not a rumour or anything. This is what's going to happen is a war, basically.
So I take it then this would be before the February meeting where Packer came in. Would have been some point, say, between November and February?
Yeah, probably. It's hard for me to put a date on it, but it was before then.
Yeah.
So it was just Quayle painting a bit of a picture about he'd had contacts from people telling him, you know, these are the stories that are going around, this is happening, you know. So it was a sense of that building, this was building, it was going to build into something very big. And the pack, you know, so many things happened from that point, didn't they? Mm.
So what were your thoughts of it just as a pure concept, leaving out the ownership and the bitterness, the rest of it out? What did you think of the idea?
I think the idea certainly had considerable merit. You know, it was certainly Humphrey's exit. Humphrey's left the league with his sort of blueprint, which was a reduction in the number of Sydney teams and a change in the structure just to make the game more attractive to people and that sort of thing. So the idea was there. But the idea that the men around League hated was the idea of someone coming in, paying vast amounts of money to players and heading to the courts and that sort of thing and stealing the game away. That's what they saw, this game that had been such a strong factor in Sydney life, really, since, 1908 or soon afterwards. You know, it'd been there a long time, been a lot of part of people's, a lot of people's upbringing, yours, mine, I guess, you know. My own involvement with it went back to being taken to a test match in 1950, Australia, England versus Australia, by a couple of uncles, you know, and capturing at the Sydney Cricket Ground in the mud, you know, all the dramas. But a wonderful and historic game. And at that, I was then 43, I was 7 years of age, stood on the hill at the back. Blokes near me stood on beer bottles pushed into the ground. And it was, and Australia won the test, the first one in 15 years, I think it was. And that really imprinted. I felt there was almost an imprint then. That was something special. And the game, you know, I had the building sense as a young bloke that the game was a special game, and I became an East supporter. We'd go to the games each week, get the tram or something out the red, you know, wherever we were going. You know, a mate of mine and myself, we used to go and watch the game. I really thought the game was a terrific game, you know, and I'm sure that view is mirrored in all those people who were involved. Maybe not the business people on the side, they just did the job, you know. Once the Murdoch chase really became heavy, they had all the professional people in there who were quite possibly not league people at all, or not that interested, but they're interested in the concept of a business proposition. And they, yeah, so it was part of the lives of all of us, I suppose. And as I said, certainly me.
So at that dinner with Quayle, did he have his kind of back up already? He was, you know, digging in for a fight?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he was a tough player, Quayle. He was a good player, you know, really good mobile back rower. And but he played the game fair and hard, and he played for Australia. But I think then, yeah, he was mustering his thoughts and trying to get support around himself to thwart any whatever challenge came. And he was, to me, he was the ideal bloke for it. He was the modern bloke, but also the bloke with an ancient love of rugby league. Mm. Been part of his life forever too. So he was a good choice for the league. He was always going to make it tough for anyone that tried to take over the game, and he did, you know. It was a hell of a struggle, as we know.
Which is probably part of the reason that almost from the outset, any talk of compromise from the Murdoch side included Quayle's head on a plate. Do you remember much of that, or if Quayle talked about that?
Well, I think they probably came to hate Quayle, I think, in the end, the Murdoch cook, but that was in its own way, that was a tribute to him, you know, that he was a tough opponent, really. The funny thing is now that he's accepted, you know, we're talking a long way further down the track, there's the acceptance there that he's a considerable talent in the game, and he has been all the way through. And if he'd been more, you know, there'd been more accepting of that during the Super League war, there mightn't have been a war. There might have been able to work out something. Because I think Quayle had the theory that the game had to change. There were things that had to change within the game. But it just became a brawl, you know, we're bigger than you, we'll take over. And yeah, pretty ugly time.
Well, let's turn to just after April Fool's Day. It just happened to coincide with the 25th anniversary of Rugby League Week. They'd planned out their anniversary edition to come out on the Wednesday. You know, Saturday morning, the raid happens and Rugby League changes forever. I thought it was interesting that I guess so much work had been done on the issue already, but Rugby League Week chose to still focus on the anniversary. And, you know, I think Norm Tasker had a little editorial column going, oh, we're not going to let them be party poopers. We're going to celebrate and we'll deal with the rest.
Yeah.
Do you remember like that specific time at Rugby League Week in particular?
Well, yes, I certainly remember that time. So I'd left them at that stage, but I was still writing, occasionally writing stuff for them, including a column, which was supposedly a mysterious column that nobody knew who wrote it, but in fact I wrote it. But each week,
so you were still writing that in 1995, the Sherlock column, were you?
The years run into each other a bit, but I wrote it for quite a long time because I enjoyed it. I had a bit of fun doing it, but I think it was regarded as something of a, you know, who is this bloke? But I put my hand up. It wasn't me, in fact. But it was a bit of fun. I enjoyed it, and it was a bit of, you could get a bit of humour into it, but also some good, you know, some hard stuff. just kept my hand in, and I had to, I was a father of two kids, I had a family bloke, I had to earn some money too, you know. I think that Rugby League Week, that weekend, you know, retained that, as you sort of suggest, a sort of traditional thing. I think that was in line with that magazine, really. It'd been around a long time, been a Bible. Wasn't quite that, but it was very popular and much sought after, and probably may well be missed these days. I don't know.
Oh, very much so. Well, certainly by me anyway.
Mm.
But the following week, when, you know, it could be avoided no longer, there's that famous cover, A Game in Ruins, picture of the Dresden bombing on the front. And, I mean, you've kind of spelled out maybe your personal allegiances. I think Norm Tasker was along the same lines. But very quickly, the publication moved from a, you know, what's happening here, to playing it pretty straight down the line, covering both sides of the game, and, you know, that going all the way through to 97, covering both comps. Had you spoken to Norm about that editorial decision, or was that something that was talked about?
I don't think I had any. I certainly spoke to Norm. You know, we talked about what was going to happen, but it was certainly his belief that League Week had to continue to play a straight bat to an extent, but could certainly take a stance in columnists and that sort of thing, and that happened. It's all so long ago, it's just hard for me to think about what it was like, except that every week was a bit of a battle. But, and I certainly, you know, I went on and wrote for the, writing for the Herald and things. I wrote some strong stuff, anti, you know, it was always crooked on what had happened, you know, it wasn't the way to do it. I mean, they could have worked out, that's the thing that makes anyone who cares about the game a bit miffed, I think, to think, you know, you feel like shaking them and say, why didn't you do it that way? You know, it was, the game was always going to be a success. It was going to work for a lot of people, players, everybody, you know. But no, they went the other way. But, I didn't get too involved with League Week then, except I wrote the column. Occasionally would write a feature story or something for them. But I'd left them and I'd moved on to the Herald, and then the Sun Herald, you know, wrote a column there too.
Yeah.
The chance to, and I probably got angrier too. I probably wrote some things, some fairly bitter things in, but that's just the way I felt about it, you know.
It was actually, we had a chapter of our series on the media landscape in 1995, and as a case study in how sad and how bitter it got, I took some of your columns, some of Norm Tasker's columns, and it was just really sad to put these all in a row and see both of you. Like, you could see the spirit and the passion for the game just, like, dwindling by the week.
Yeah, it was very draining, yeah, that's for sure. I mean, Norm and I started together pretty much at the Telegraph, you know, at the same time. Well, Norm was might have been a year and a half ahead of me or something. It was Copy Boys and then, you know, Cadet Journos and things. But he went on the path. Rugby was more his game, but he was a keen league bloke too. He liked the game of league as well. Covered the league for quite a, you know, on and off over the years as I did. And used to go to the Monday night meetings before I went. I think I took over from Norm to go down there. But, it did get sort of got sadder writing about it each week, because I suppose you felt a bit, I don't know what the word is, a bit helpless in a way. You know, there's these towering giants with all their money and things were ripping and tearing at the game. And you could provide a few words where you could say angry things about how you felt about certain things that had happened. But eventually I think we all realised it was going to have to work itself out somehow in the end.
And that's the thing. Pretty quickly, it wasn't just the Murdoch side that you were writing against. You had some harsh words for the ARL and what was happening on that side too over the course of the war. Are there any moments that stand out or things you thought that the ARL weren't doing correctly?
I think I had the sense then of them going into the bunker, you know, it became like a war situation really. And I don't know that there was anything particularly different. I think I thought I'd been good mates with Quayle, you know, before that, long before he came to Sydney, you know, and I was supportive of him and his side and what, because I believed in the fact that the league were being wronged, you know. But so I did try and be positive, I suppose, about him, you know, much of the time. I'm waffling on here a bit, but as for the league taking any particularly different stand, I think they're natural. I mean, they're tough guys. That sort of thing. Their natural response to something like that is, you know, we're going to rip in here because we'll fight till the end and all this stuff. You know, there was talk like that too. So it was, you know, called the Super. It was, you know, Super League War was right. Exactly what it was. It was a lot of ugliness, a lot of hatred. But certainly, it filled the newspapers, didn't it? It became a good read.
Yeah.
And it's looked back on now, and it's, you know, it's settled down again. The game's back into a pretty good groove, probably.
And it took us 25 years to recover.
It was a painful exercise. You know, the game had experienced nothing like that. You know, there was a big threat from radio back in the 1930s. You know, and there was a big battle on then. Because radio had put into to broadcast. I think the game was first broadcast in the 1920s, and then in the 1930s, this radio, similar thing probably in a way. Radio saw this a bit of a chance for us. You know, we'll call the radio thing. We'll call the match each week. But within the league itself, at those Monday night meetings, there was big resentment to that because they could see all the punters staying away from the game because they'd be staying at home listening to their little mantle radio. You know, they wouldn't be going to the football, which was drawing a long bow probably. But it did exist, you know. So that was a sort of a distant forerunner to rugby league. What happened with the league, I suppose, that this sense of something being nicked away from them that was theirs. And, you know, with all of those blokes, there was blood, sweat and tears. They'd played the game hard at a very hard time. They'd fought for it to get going, you know, in the early years, that sort of thing. So I can understand, yeah. And that message was carried on down into the more modern times too, you know. The Buckleys and those people, you know, they were pioneering types who believed in the game and fought for it, you know. So they were always going to fight for it. If it was still going now, the war, they'd be in there fighting probably. Mm. And good on them, you know.
Interestingly, though, it wasn't just the insiders, it wasn't just club bosses and game officials. One of the ugliest parts of the whole war was how the journalistic fraternity fell out. You had people on different publications never speaking to each other again and all this like bitterness going on. And, I mean, you were in the middle of that. What did you make of that side of things?
Yeah, that was sort of unfortunate, I suppose, but not unexpected. Within the framework, the bitterness of the fight that was unfolding, you know, I was seen as a traditionalist who, I tried to, you know, write with balance and, you know, the things I wrote that were, but I lent towards the traditional game because that had been my game too, you know, but I had a, you know, Peter Frelingos and I fell out, we'd been mates, you know, over the years. I think he labelled me a dinosaur, but I sort of accepted that quite happily because I don't mind dinosaurs. They're good survivors. You know? They've been around a while.
Speak to my son about it. He'll agree with you.
I suppose a good example that things eventually get fixed or they heal themselves in the end, that Peter and I don't think we ever became great mates again, but by chance we've both lived in the Eastern Suburbs and we both used to walk dogs. So we'd run into each other and we'd have a yarn and talk and things, you know, and then things got better. He just got on with his life and I got on with mine, and probably I saw him this night with Joy, with my wife, at the quail function where it all sort of blew up. And then I remember Peter at that being, who'd been a traditionalist, you know, he'd spoken to quail on the phone every morning or Arco, and he was a good reporter. He'd done the job really well, but that night, his response was sort of largely him talking to himself, what am I going to do? You know, if he could see the game being stolen away, he was genuinely concerned about what was going to happen. But what happened was he took a position eventually, and I don't blame him for it. It just happened that being part of the Murdoch press, I guess he felt, whether he's, you know, looked after in any way, I don't know. But he was a well-paid journalist, as he should have been. You know, he was a good journalist. But he took the line of supporting Murdoch, the Murdoch challenge, you know, and that's the way business works, I suppose. Yeah.
In your latest book with Norm Tasker, Great Australian Sporting Stories, you talk about Peter Frelingos, and you called it the Road to Damascus moment of him, you know, the legendary story of him being pro-ARL one day, going to a mysterious meeting, coming out and, you know, being Super League's biggest spruiker. And his credibility took a bit of a hit in the aftermath to that. And I think a lot of people, from what I've seen, weren't as forgiving as you were about that. Did you go to his funeral?
Yes. I did, yeah, because I've known him a long time. We've been in the same business. Things have possibly healed a little bit then, but we weren't ever mates again, except that we finished up years later on one of the kangaroo tours. I'd gone over there with a touring group, I think. Peter was there, and there were some other journos there and things, and I saw a lot of him there, and it was... by then, it had, you know, time's a great healer, isn't it? And I think that had played its part too. But I don't think we're ever the great mates. You know, we sort of almost grew up together in covering the game, learning the ropes from the Mike Gibsons and the Ernie Christensens and the Bill Mortys and those sort of fellows. There were some terrific teachers then, you know. So we learnt the ropes then, went slightly different ways, but then there was this great separation for quite a time. But, you know, Peter did what he thought was right, I'm sure. But I understand the anger of, there were a lot of people very angry about what he did. You know, there wasn't, you know, he just wrote it the way he felt he had to from that point onwards, I suppose. So then he died some years later, which was very sad, you know. But, so I don't think the game had ever confronted anything like that. There was certainly opposition amongst the newspaper people. It was very hotly contested, you know, as that world is, the media world. But
had something changed? Did something change at that moment, or were things already changing in terms of, right, you know, journalists at rival publications, you know, interacting and fraternising? Had something already changed before Super League, or did that become a real turning point?
I think a lot of things changed in the game then. I think it was pretty standard game. One thing that we had, that I don't think the current, you know, current media people have this advantage, and there were things that blokes like Frelingos, Mike Gibson and I and Clark and so forth that we had, was the friendship factor with the game and the teams and the clubs to an extent. I mean, we used to go to a match, and then afterwards, inevitably, well, you would, it was part of the deal, you'd go to the dressing room and be welcomed at the door, usually with a beer, come in, and then be invited to, you know, you had free rein to go around and talk to the players and about the game and about what happened. And it was just a friendship thing, and that was all clubs, you know. That was the odd work then. So all of that disappeared, of course, once the battle went on. That was out the window, and I don't think anyone goes into dressing rooms anymore.
No, you've got the media managers and all the rest of it.
And maybe that's, in a way, because the media's got bigger, that's progress, I suppose, excuse me, in one way. But it was a really nice thing to happen, you know. And there's a fair chance, too, that if you went to a St George match, you'd go back over to the club and have a couple of beers with Frank Facer and the blokes over there. So there's that lovely link between that generation of sports journos like myself and Frelingos and the others, the younger ones, that we were accepted by the game, you know. And to get to talk to a player, you know, in the years that I covered it, all I had to do was pick up the phone and ring them. You know, there wasn't any great... I didn't have to ring a manager or anyone. If they thought you were fair dinkum and you were reported fairly, that was as good as gold. I could ring Graham Langlands, who would then abuse me, but he did it in a nice way. You know? But it was like that with all the players. And that's so, when I think about me and rugby league, it's been certainly a fortunate life in having that experience too, of being able, and then go away on the tours and be part of the Kangaroo World Cup touring teams, the fringe dweller, but still accepted as one of the group. And again, that same access to dressing rooms and the special press conference every morning from Harry Bath or someone, you know. It was a lovely setup, you know. And I suppose life works like that. You might go through a lucky phase where you're doing something you like doing, but it can change pretty quickly, you know. And I think the journalists today have got a much harder job because of the they don't get much connection with the player after the game, do they?
No.
They get any at all?
I think in some, I'm not a journalist, so I'm not an insider. I know it's very difficult for them. There's no calling the coach for the team list or, you know, just calling up a player out of the blue. That seems to not be a thing that happens these days.
Yeah. It's a harder gig, for sure. I think one of my first jobs was every Tuesday night I had to do the ring around of the clubs. And that meant ringing some of these old crusty blokes and all sorts of different types of fellas, but it was always very friendly. I'd ring up to get the teams, so they'd be in the Telegraph the next day, you know. So I'd ring the teams, and it was always, you were well received. Yeah, we've dropped so and so. And there might be a slight discussion about whether they should have or not, that sort of thing, you know. But once again, that's just changed, I suppose, in life. I suppose if I put it in quotes, I had a fortunate life in league in covering it during that period and being able to go on the tours. And the interstate, it wasn't just, the English tours here were terrific because they meant there was a whole education travelling around with the tours, playing, watching the English team play in Darwin and then being part of following them all over the place. There was a lot of things you learned along the way, and I learned a lot too from those old journos I mentioned to you of Morty and Clarko, who were bitter rivals and yet great mates too, both punters, but respected each other. One never drank. One never ate, so they were rather different in their own way. They're a colourful pair. I think I call them the odd couple in that latest book, actually. They're terrific blokes. And there was generous help. I got the most help I got from it as a young journalist was from Tom Goodman. I was working for the Telegraph. Tom Goodman was the great cricket and rugby league writer for the Herald. Wonderful bloke, Tom. Really terrific. Any help he could give, he would give, even though I was in the opposite side of the fence, That was a really nice thing about league, And so it was just, when it blew up, that was a shame. All of that was gone, forever, I suppose, pretty much.
Well, a really striking thing I've found in my research, this was an article you wrote in, I think it was March 96. The title of the article was "The Game's Soul is Bleeding." It was a withering article. I mean, written in strong words, not mean words, but very sad portrayal of how everything was happening with a lot of, pointed criticism of the ARL.
Mm.
The following week, you turned over your column to the ARL to write their rebuttal to what you'd written. And I flabbergasted to see that. You could not imagine a scenario today where something similar would happen. And what I thought of was that maybe for you and from the administration side, there was an idea of like a mutual obligation.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. I don't specifically remember that. You write so many words over the years, I suppose, that it all runs into each other a bit. But, I didn't reconnect with the new games or the clubs that had broken away to any great extent, but I did to an extent because I was still a journalist and I knew, the Peter Moores and the Charlie Gibsons and all those people. Not that Charlie went across, but Peter was, a strong figure in the game, obviously. But he was a genial fellow who I toured with in a way. That sort of friendship, you don't gun it down straight away, So there was a bit of that went on. But, it's funny when you mentioned stories that I wrote. Sometimes I look at the piles in my wife probably does too, in my office and thinks, what the hell? I can't believe sometimes they pick up stories and I think, I didn't write that. But I did, of course I did, So, it was good, and it's good that the record's still there and I'm going to try and retain that. I'm not going to burn it or anything.
Mm.
Well, my wife might overrule me. This is possible.
And, just after, or as the war was settling down, you wrote the Ken Arthurson book with him, which is an amazing document of the time. Like, he really seemed like an open wound. The way it comes off the page then.
Yeah.
Can you remember his state at the time, his emotions dealing with everything that had happened?
Yeah, and I think it's a good phrase you use, the open wound. I think he was really hurt by it because he genuinely loved the game, Darko, and he loved Manly a bit more probably, a fraction more, but not that much more. But so he had that, and he played the game, in his career was he was lucky to be alive. He got seriously injured playing rugby league. That never dulled him on the game. He loved the game and loved the friendships of it and all the sidelines, you know, and a very affable bloke. He was a good foil for Quayle because Quayle was more blunt about things. Arco's more the... he took a softer line to an extent. He was a hail fellow, well met, Arco. You know, if he walked in here now, you'd say his demeanour would be how pleased he'd be to meet you and he'd be genuine, you know. So he... But he was very hurt by the whole thing. Had probably shone through in that book, didn't it? I think it just... The thing galloped away from him. Mm. I think he probably thought initially he might be able to put the lid on it, but it was never going to be easy to do that.
Yeah. I mean, reading it, you know, 20-odd years later, I was actually stunned that, and, you know, happily so that he's still with us now and seems to be going well at 9 years of age. But he really seemed like something had broken at that point in him.
There's a story which is at the back of my head, which is about he and Peter Moore. You know, they were genuinely very good mates, and, you know, they were part of the cartel of the league, and they were good thinkers on the game, and so they were good contributors really in their own way. Well, this particular day, which I don't know if I've ever mentioned this in our private talks, but of an event, that launch of that book, actually, at the hotel in Sydney, the Hyde Park Hotel, I think it was, of where the book was launched and all. There was a big team of rugby league people invited there, and it was right in the middle of the Super League, the nastiness, you know, at that time. And there's Arco, I suppose the fact that we had a book launch, you know, was... The publishers, who was probably Pam McMillan, I think, I can't remember, but so they had a book launch there, and people gathered to Arco's friends gathered. But the sight of the evening to me that night was Bullfrog Moore walking into the building and walking down to where Ken was down the front, and he hadn't been invited to the function. I don't think he certainly wasn't invited by the publishers or whatever, but he turned up out of friendship, you know. I spoke to him afterwards that night. I said, and when I think about it now, I think that's one of the bravest things I've ever seen, because all these rugby league enemies, the people that were doing him, because they didn't trust whether he'd been honest about what had happened at Canterbury, you know, that Canterbury players had switched across, and I think John Quayle probably always thought that that Peter had been involved in that, because he was involved in everything else. He ran the club, you know. But anyway, this night, and I said to him, you know, I said something, words I just used, and I said I'd been away on a couple of tours with Peter, and I like him, genial fellow and all that. And I said, that was a very brave thing you did coming here tonight, because there was plenty of dark faces around the room, scowling faces, that he was there. And he said, I had to be here for Ken. He said, we've been mates throughout our life. So he did that, you know, and it must have been a hard thing to do, you know, because he knew he was going to walk past a really angry mob. But he did it. And again, that was, I suppose, that's a throwback to the old spirit of league and friendship and all of that, you know.
Yeah, it's one of the like, genuinely beautiful things in this ugly times. You could see these two blokes just determined that whatever else was going on, and wherever the situation finds us, we're going to hang on to what we've had for so long.
Yeah, I think it might have been as sort of sealed in those blokes as well as you put it there, that it was that they, all the things that happened in league in the past meant a lot to them, and the friendships particularly, I think. So, yeah. Anyway, yeah, that night's always... And the other thing about Bullfrog, too, who was a controversial character in the whole, you know, the months that went on, you know, he had plenty of enemies, and I bet he got plenty of flack, too. But he became very ill, Bullfrog, and he had cancer surgery, and he was on fading, and I'd been in touch with the family and things. And we got the message from... one of the boys, I think, that he was at a pretty low ebb, and I said, couple of guys would like to come and see him, you know, we'd like to come and say hello. He said, yeah, that'd be terrific for him. So these are all sort of this lineup that I can think of were all pretty much proactive traditional rugby league blokes, you know, and they were the doubt about Bullfrog, you know, what he did. But there were about six, seven or eight of us turned up there. Gary Lester and Prenter was there, I think Jeff Prenter and Alan Clarkson and myself and a few others, to say, you know, it was our farewell to Peter. And it was a very emotional sort of event, you know, and he appreciated it, and there were tears and all sorts of things. And and he had been a really good friend. He understood how the media worked, you know, he had that sense of how it worked. The other thing he did several times was when I was away on tours, Kangaroo Tours, which and leaving Joy, my wife, here, and she was with two children and possibly a dog. She, you know, life wasn't easy. I'm gone for some months, you know, covering tours in England and France. Peter was the one bloke who now and then would just give her a ring, just to give her a call and say, just wondered how you're getting on, conveying that message, which said a lot about him too, I think. There was nothing contrived in it. He knew Joy, knew me, you know. So they're the sort of nice things, you know. They're part of the nastiness in a way, but they're, there's those sunbeams within the whole fairly dark story of the Super League thing, you know. Good things like that, yeah.
It was probably the highlight of my research journey so far was researching our Bullfrog chapter, which you gave us some great help with, but what a character. Like, yeah. He's got to be one of the all-timers, right?
Yeah, I think you're right, yeah. He had a great sense of how things worked, you know. The other story that Bullfrog, if we're talking about Bullfrog, yeah, the other story that always, the vision that stays with me is being away on the tour, Kangaroo Tour was 1978, the touring team playing in England, training hard. But being a training, they're all gathered there at training. We used to go with the journos, in case something happened, someone broke down or something. But there's great excitement, and there's a big event on. Bullfrogs challenged Larry Corowa to a 100-metre sprint. Larry Corowa being the fastest man in rugby league by a fair space. Brilliantly quick, you know, Aboriginal athlete and great tourist on that tour. He did a great job, Larry. And Bullfrog, who did do some push-ups of a morning, I can remember, on the tours. I recall that, but was not built for speed. Bullfrog, you know, he carried a bit of weight and things. But anyway, so there were some bets went on, you know, the race was finally run. Started in a traditional manner with a clap of the hands and off they went. With Bulldog had a handicap, you know, so he got the handicap. There's Bullfrog, rather large, and Larry, very athletic and trim. And they ran the 100 yards. You wouldn't want to know, Bullfrog won it. Larry took some ground off him, obviously, yeah. but Bullfrog somehow won it. But then I was talking to him afterwards, and he told me, a formula about that if you can in a running race, if you give someone a certain amount of start, you know, which is a fair lump of start, you know, and win, or if you get that much start in a race, you can beat quick blokes, you know, because it's something about the trick of the eye or something, and that's exactly what happened that day. Everyone thought Larry's going to win, and Larry probably thought Larry's going to win, but they didn't know about Bullfrog's little, you know, his little. This little plan he had, where he moved a bit quicker than they thought. So there I was. I was there the day that Bullfrog beat Larry. I'm sure the guys on that tour still talk about that. Yeah. Wonder what happened.
Just to finish up, I wanted to talk about your, you know, exit from the game in terms of being, you know, a regular writer in the papers. You moved over to the Murdoch side. Some stage 96, 97 around then,
yeah.
Wasn't it?
Yeah.
Can you talk about that move and how that played out for you?
Yeah. Yeah. The fact of it was a sort of muddled time in my career with the Super League thing raging around. I wrote for the Sun Herald for probably a few years, several years, and enjoyed it. You know, good staff there, good editor, good sub-editors, and I enjoyed it a great deal. And I wrote probably some reasonable stuff there, actually, and so I enjoyed doing that. I was always going to go there because I wasn't going to go to the Super League side of the fence, you know. So I would write for them, and they wanted me to write objectively and do that, you know. So I did, and I enjoyed that thoroughly. And then there came to I can't remember the dates or the times. The end of there was a change of staff there, and they called me in, and they said, there's a new sporting editor and his assistant. They were blokes I didn't know. And they talked about, oh, yes, well, you've done some good work for us. And there was this conversation, you know. I said, but we've decided we're going to have to cut you back. And I wasn't writing for much. There wasn't much money. It was a fair, what I got was a fair, for what I did was reasonable. But these blokes, one of them who I'd known before, I didn't like him much. They said, we're going to have to chop you back. We're falling, you know, times a bit hard. So they cut me back quite substantially, and I had a family to feed and so forth. So I wasn't happy about it, but that's their call, you know, so they did it. But then probably a few weeks after that, I got a call from the Telegraph. Might have even been Buzz Rothfield. I think Buzz was involved in the thing. And he said, just wondered if you might be interested in having a talk about the Super League thing was rolling. And I'd written a lot of stuff. And probably, there was a little bit of respect for me as one of the senior blokes in the game, that sort of thing. And so I went and had lunch with Rothfield and one of their Murdoch bosses there, and they made me an offer, which I thought, I can't believe this has happened, but it had, and it was substantially more than the offer from the other place, and there was all these reassurances, which most of which they kept up to, and I say, you'll have a free reign, you know, you can write what you like. That's what I think, you know, my name wasn't too bad. They were keen, you know, if they have me on board, it's not going to do them any harm. So, with great reluctance. In a way, I accepted it. I said, because it was mainly to do with my personal situation, you know, trying to earn a living. So I did. I wrote for the, I can't remember what I would have written for them, but I wrote stuff for them. I don't know if you've got any of that, have you?
I'm not up to that yet, but no, okay. I'll be coming across it soon enough.
Interesting on that, actually. But anyway, so I finished up. Yeah, I was, I think some people were, you know, I didn't feel I had to explain myself, but some people were disappointed. You know, they were surprised that I would do that. But, you know, blood's sort of thicker than water, isn't it? And I did it for a very fundamental reason, I guess, that I had been earning good money, and I thought I'd been doing a pretty solid job for the... I was just dirty on the way they did it. You know, It was very abrupt and all that. So I was dirty on them. You know, but I'm finishing up at working for the Sunday Telegraph. I didn't think I was going to do that either. But anyway, I did, yeah. So it was a bit of a surprise to me too.
And can we talk about that exit from the Telegraph a couple of years after that?
Yeah. I'm not sure of the time factor. I was certainly with them for a while, and to their credit, they gave me pretty much a fair go. You know, I didn't rip in and say Rupert Murdoch's a mug or anything, but I wrote some stuff that was certainly negative from their point of view, without any question. But with South Sydney under the hammer and the pride of the league, a club I'd always had great respect for and knew their history so well. And they were looking shaky, and that's when all the fight back began, and the Super League war was thoroughly underway. They were with Souths at the heart of it and fighting for their lives. But I wrote a piece for them on Saturday morning about the big march that was coming up the following day, which was a march to help the cause of saving South Sydney. Could have been the Friday, right? A Friday or the Saturday that week anyway, and I thought it was a strong story because I knew then they'd tell me that this very elderly man who was part of... Sorry, I just lost his name fractionally. I don't know if you've got it there. I've got it. I'll think of it in a sec. That he was a wonderful supporter of South and had given away his treasures to...
Oh, is this Albert Clift?
Albert Clift, yeah. Albert Clift it was, yeah. And he was going to lead the march in a wheelchair to the town hall, and there would be this great march of protest to the town hall. So I wrote a piece, it was on the Saturday actually, for the which was for the Sunday Telegraph, which was a news story about the fact that I'd rung around the bush a bit, and there was this great, uncovered the fact that very many bush people were coming to Sydney to march in the march because they felt so crooked about what was being done to South, the pride of the league, the most achieving club in the league, producer of wonderful players and that sort of thing. And it was a pretty solemn kick in the teeth, which I don't think New Zealand would ever quite realise what taking on South, you know, what real. So I wrote a piece and I said it would be probably the biggest sporting protest march ever held in Australia. Anyway, They didn't run the story. That was the fact. They managed next day the story didn't run. And I think the following day, I don't think that's probably in one of those pieces there, but they didn't cover the march, you know, which was a lead item on television, Channel 9 and things. So that weekend, whenever I saw what had happened, you know, what they'd done, it was so arrogant to say, oh, we can just ride over this, you know, this will be okay. Then the next was a Sunday, and I went to a family gathering somewhere, and I'd been mulling over what I was going to do. And it was on that day that I made my decision I was going to pull the plug. So I rang, I don't think they worked the, probably the Monday, I think it was the Monday, I rang Telegraph Sporting's sporting editor, and it was a fellow I got on with very well, good bloke, and they'd been okay to me, you know. And I just explained, I said, I'm very busy in what I'm doing in my life. I said, and I explained, I thought they'd done completely the wrong thing. In brief terms, I didn't make a huge issue of it. I just said, giving you my resignation. So that's what happened, you know. Suddenly it was something that lifted off me a little bit, to an extent that I was surprised. I was still surprising myself that I was working for years later. You know, people had said things to me, including a few sharpish things that they thought, they didn't think I'd be there working for them.
Mm.
And I probably didn't either, you know, but I was. So I pulled the plug, and that was it. That was pretty much the end of my rugby league career in that form, you know, but I managed to soldier on and do some stuff, write some books, and there's always another. So other doors opened, so I didn't regret it. I felt pretty good about it, you know.
So just to finish, that's a sad ending to that chapter of your life, in a very sad chapter of the game's history. Where are you now with rugby league, looking back at all of that and where you're sitting now? How are you feeling about the game?
I'm feeling okay, pretty okay about it. I mean, I feel very detached. I'm not really part of it anymore. But I watch the game still. And I think it's developing, you know, it's I hate that word product. I won't use that. But it's a terrific television, exciting medium, really, to see up close, to see what goes on. You know, it's such a fierce game. It's always been that way. It's the bigger athletes now, it's probably even fiercer than it's ever been. You know, they're huge players compared with some who played in the past. So I'm feeling all right about it. I'm still friends with lots of people in the game, and what happened with me was just something that happened. You know, I did continue to write for League Week after that, when Norm was still running it. So I continued to write some stuff. You know, then I gradually faded back to... But now and then, like, someone calls me and says, oh, could you do us a piece on this or something? So I haven't completely departed the building.
I'm still involved with the Hall of Fame, the Immortals announcement last year.
Yeah, yeah. Occasionally I've done things for the league, and I've just written a big piece on the fact of my having been at the Sydney Cricket Ground at that famous day, 1950, straight away gone to ashes. You know, that was the beginning for me. Well, the ending's come sort of since, but I'm still around. But I've written a piece. I really dug deep into that day, what it was like from a personal point of view. Me as a kid standing on the hill, a short-sighted young bloke actually, so I probably wasn't seeing that well, but still remember all the things, the hats going in the air and all this. So I've written a piece about that for them. So I occasionally get calls like that, you know, too, which they'll run in a magazine somewhere, and I'll tell you if I've done something else.
But in the meantime, I think we've brought it full circle now. So that was great hearing all that in. So thanks so much for joining me today.
It's a great pleasure, mate. Thanks for your patience and your assistance in guiding an old rugby league scribe through a preacher.
Okay,
good luck
you.
With the project too, mate.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
Okay, we will speak to you next week.
Okay.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.